Okay, so one of the less understood things about an hour-long podcast is that it actually takes quite a few hours behind the scenes to make. You're lining up different people's schedules, you're writing scripts, editing audio, making it feel effortless actually takes a bit of effort. That's why I want to recommend Notion. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired too, so that when it comes time to hit the record button, everyone's on the same page, where TeamSpace or Calendar or QuickNote have a play around, they're all there. Notion combines your collaborations into one space that's simple and clear, and it also has some AI running in the background to help things along. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/squared. And just an FYI, that's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting what we do here on the show too. That's notion.com/squared.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to the Intelligence Squared podcast. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. Coming up, Muppets in Moscow. We'll be joined by Natasha Lanzrogoff, the television producer tasked with bringing one of the US's most warmly regarded kids' TV exports, Sesame Street, to the slightly chillier audiences found around TV sets in Russia during the early 1990s. Our host for today's discussion is Carl Miller, Research Director for the Center of Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos. Here's Carl with more.
Well, folks, a very warm welcome from me as well. And I'm truly, truly delighted to introduce our guest, Natasha Lanzrogoff. She is an award-winning television producer, filmmaker and journalist who's produced television news and documentaries in Russia, Ukraine and the former Soviet Union. She was the executive producer on Ulitsa Sezam, the Russian adaptation of Sesame Street between 1993 and 97, and also made Plaza Sésamo in Mexico. That won't be the last name that I will not pronounce correctly today. She's an associate fellow at Harvard University and, of course, is the author of this, Muppets in Moscow, the unexpected, crazy true story of making Sesame Street in Russia. Well, Natasha, very, very warm welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me tonight, Carl. It's great to be here.
Okay, so set the scene for us. Where did the initial idea for taking Sesame Street to Russia, where did it come from?
Well, the workshop, Sesame Workshop, which is the producer of Sesame Street in the United States and international co-productions around the world, they had spoken with then Senator Biden. And he at that time was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee. So at this point, it was late 1992. And the Soviet Union had collapsed a year earlier. It was a period of absolutely historically unprecedented change. And Sesame Street and Senator Biden imagined that the Muppets could be ambassadors who could model idealistic values about tolerance, freedom of expression, as well as, you know, transferring skills to young children so that they could thrive in a new open society. So Biden spearheaded congressional approval, bipartisan approval, for some financing for an original Russian Sesame Street show to be produced. And I was tasked to lead that team.
And so how, Natasha, how did the job end up being yours? I mean, what were you doing at the time when all of these, you know, moves were being made to bring the Muppets over to Moscow?
I thought I was absolutely the last person that should be doing this show. I mean, I had been in the Soviet Union for the previous 10 years directing documentaries and producing news for CNN and CBS and Channel 4 as well. And, I made serious films. The last one I did was called Russia for Sale, The Rough Road to Capitalism. And I had embedded myself with what I considered communist fascists who wanted to do everything they could to avoid the Soviet Union imploding. They were anti-Western, anti-Semitic. They were really, really frightening people. But the Sesame Street executives came to a screening I had in New York City and then approached me and said, you know, we're having some trouble, you know, finding a broadcaster and a partner in Russia. This is, you know, after the Soviet Union had collapsed. And I just looked at them and said, did you just watch my film that was just screened? I mean, it was as far as you could imagine from the Muppets, you know, from their lighthearted, absolutely delightful comedy. But they said, you know, we see that you, you know, have worked in Russian television as well, and we'd like you to consider it. And I was intrigued. I mean, I thought everybody knew the Muppets, and I loved them, even though I did not grow up with them because the show aired in 1969 and I was born earlier. But I was game. Of course, I totally underestimated the challenges that we would face.
So you take the job and you arrive, I know, in Moscow during one of the early visits to start to line up all the different backers and supporters that you would need. Can you kind of paint the picture for us a little bit of what Russia was like then in those kind of very early Soviet years? I know you were meeting Boris Berezovsky and all of these kind of figures that we would now kind of associate with organized crime.
Mm. Well, it was in the early days of the transition, but at the same time, this was a period when the West was euphoric about the idea of Russia and the new independent states joining the free world. It was heady stuff. I mean, at the same time, there were bankers, investors, religious figures all flooding into what was the former Soviet Union with the idea of making a lot of money, you know, converting people. And it was also an incredible period of instability. So for many Soviet citizens, this was a time of extreme difficulty, economic difficulty, as well as emotional difficulty. They were a superpower. The world had just watched their country fall apart. So it was into this landscape that, you know, I was thrust with my team from Sesame Workshop in New York City. And I had a partner that I had selected, a very good friend of mine, Leonid Zagalski. One of our first meetings was with Boris Berezovsky, who had become a rising star and media mogul. He was not at the level he later became. And at this point, there was really no easy internet access. So the information that we had about who people were had to rely on other people in the TV industry in Moscow who spoke with us about who these people were. And we had this meeting with Berezovsky. It took us months to get it. And finally, we meet in a Japanese restaurant. It was one of the first restaurants in Moscow. And we, you know, I was just thrilled telling him about Sesame Street and focusing on the philanthropic angle and how it could help millions of children, as well as that it was an original production. So we would be not creating just an import, but creating an original program with three new Slavic-style Muppets with their own unique design that would reflect Russian and post-Soviet culture and values, as well as a brand new set, you know, a huge neighborhood. So he was very intrigued. And then he asked if Big Bird was going to be in the show. And I thought that was, I loved hearing this, you know, rising oligarch talk at Big Bird. I was like, yeah, I think maybe he's getting a little excited. And then, but he was kind of a scary guy. He had two enormous bodyguards with him. And I was like, you know, I don't think they're going to be satisfied eating a little bit of raw fish. And then anyway, by the end of the meeting, after he thought about the numbers and what was involved, he agreed to become the show sponsor. So we were thrilled, Leonid and I. And we all agreed that over the next couple weeks, Leonid would follow up with Berezovsky's lawyers and get the paperwork that we needed. And I went back to the States. 3 weeks later, I got a phone call from Leonid, who was very upset on the phone, and he explained that Berezovsky's car had been blown up, and he had severe burns on his body, and he survived, we found out later, but he wasn't interested in continuing the discussion about the children's puppet show after that. So we had to start from scratch again.
And Berezovsky wasn't the only business person that encountered kind of harm, or indeed, I know that others were killed that you came to news. How was Sesame Workshop taking this kind of news when you would go back to New York and tell them that your, you know, associates and interlocutors were actually turning up, blown up, or even dead?
Well, there was a, you know, as in any company, I think, and Sesame Workshop at that time, Children's Television Workshop, is a nonprofit. And there was a certain faction within the organization that, you know, really thought we shouldn't be in Russia. They made it very clear that it was too dangerous. It was risky for the brand of the Muppets, you know, but there was another faction of people, my boss included, Baxter Urist and Gary Nell, who felt that, you know, this was an incredible opportunity and we should do everything that we could to try to make it happen. But I have to say, when I, you know, some of the ideas that I brought back as far as potential funders were not met with great excitement, to say the least. And it was a process for me of learning. I mean, I was an independent filmmaker. I hadn't worked in a corporation before. And a lot of this navigating inside a company was new to me, as well as trying to explain to my superiors that in post-communist Russia, there was no rule of law. There were no Western banks at the time that we were doing this. I mean, it was a different country. There was not even a constitution yet. So this was a period when we were trying to implement a program and follow the rules of a developed Western society when one did not exist in Russia. And also in terms of the people that we could go to find the kind of financing we needed for this show. And we had to find a partner that would match the same amount of funding as the U.S. government was going to put in. Otherwise, we weren't going to have any money from the U.S. government. So it was really challenging to find somebody who we could trust. And eventually we did, in Irina Borisova, who was one of the few women owners of an advertising and television production company. And her heart was in it. I mean, I met her. I wasn't sure if she had the money, but I trusted her. And, you know, in the book, she's just an amazing person and was like a needle in the haystack. We were very lucky to find her.
Natasha, tell us a bit about Russian television. So what did it look like in the kind of immediate kind of breakup of the Soviet Union? Was it clear to you which channel you kind of needed to convince and work with as well to get Sesame Street out?
There were really only two channels at that time. There was RTR and ORT. And these two large Moscow-based TV channels broadcast their signal across 11 time zones, so 1/7 of the world's surface. And you had to work, if you wanted your show to air, you had to air it on one of these two channels. But there was also just the beginning of cable, and a little tiny news station was budding it was called NTV, run by Igor Malashenko, who's now passed, who was a great man. And we initially went to the children's department at ORT with my colleagues from Sesame Workshop and Leonid, but that was not gonna happen. There was, the whole situation with television at that time was very unstable, because until that time, production had been supported by the state. You had a complete state-run television, as you do now in Russia. And so, and Putin has eliminated, you know, independent television for the most part entirely now. So at that time, we had to work with the state, but they had no money. And so most of the film studios, like Gorky Film Studios, Mosfilm, they were dark. They weren't producing films because there was no state sponsorship for film production. And that was also true for television. There was very limited production, and there was one other children's television show, Spokojne Nochi Malashi, which was a rather old program that was very propagandistic and didactic, and basically children watched the show before they went to bed. So we pulled all those people in. Our team numbered about 400, and this is set designers, writers, producers, animators. A lot of the animators were Georgian. Our team was multicultural. We had Russians, Ukrainians, Armenians. I mean, it was quite amazing. And we really had incredible artists, talented, passionate people who envisioned a different future for Russia. They hoped that Ulitsa Sazam would model a kinder, more tolerant, peaceful society and a peaceful neighborhood where neighbors helped each other. That's what they were trying to create, first on the little screen, and then they hoped in reality in the future.
So let's talk, Natasha, about some of those kind of artistic and creative and editorial decisions and tensions and pathways that you had to weave throughout those incredible years you were spending there. So firstly, tell us a bit about the kind of traditions and legacies that you were kind of stepping into when talking to Russians and Russian artists about children's TV and puppets. I know that there was an early suggestion to include, was it Baba Yaga? As a character on Sesame Street?
Yes. Yeah, the Russian team, the creative team, did not like the Muppets at first. And when we showed them some clips from the American show, they just said, oh, no, those puppets, they don't look Russian. And our children will not like those puppets. They would prefer our puppets. And their traditional puppets were really magnificent. They were, you know, wooden. And the chief director said, Natasha, our puppetry tradition dates back to the 16th century. And we really don't need your American Muppets. So it took months to win them over, I would say, in order to accept these different looking, you know, softer puppets with often foam or felt. And then, you know, these googly eyes. That was just a very different look. And, you know, I understood where some of my teammates were coming from. One person mentioned, you know, our children are going through such a huge transition. There's so much change in our country. At least for our children's show, we should have something that's familiar, have something that's their own, that they recognize. But, you know, eventually this group changed their mind. They came to the United States were allowed to be in New York City they had visas and were trained at Sesame Street Workshop by veteran puppeteers and producers just for a week. And they came to this decision themselves ultimately and created puppets, but not the same kind of puppets that exist for the US production. They created their own very unique puppets that were based on their own folklore.
And what were these Slavic puppets? These were kind of like negotiations, were they? Jim Henson style in the way that they were built and the way that they looked, but trying to animate and express, you know, particularly and specifically Russian values and history and aesthetics.
Well, the full body puppet, which is in the Russian version, is called Zeliboba. And he's based on a character from Russian folklore called Domovoy, who's a spirit of the hearth and the home and protects the home. And initially, the team, the Russian team, had drawn the character as an old man. And he looked he wore like a cap, like a pope or a rabbi. And he looked kind of like a religious figure. And he was omniscient. You know, he was all-knowing and would tell children how to behave. And in the conversations over time, we were like, well, what if he were more childlike? What if he made mistakes? What if he was more experimental? Wouldn't that give the writers an opportunity to have more fun with this character, to create a lighter character rather than such a didactic character? And eventually they moved in that direction. And we can show a picture of what Zeliboba looks like. He's a large blue Muppet who is taller than Big Bird. He's wearing huge white sneakers, which were based on the fact that the coordinating producer said that kids were now wearing sneakers, you know, that once the market had opened up and they had sneakers, so we wanted to make him like other young kids. And it's hard to see from this, but I think we have a closer shot. Into his coat are sewn pieces of leaves and moss and twigs. And that's because he is, like the folklore character, he is of nature and he's a tree spirit. So, you can't get more Russian than that.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Natasha, I don't know for people watching this, but for me, probably the most abiding memory of the Muppets are the songs. I remember singing along to them, and probably more than anything else, they kind of abide with you and pop up into your head.
Yeah.
And of course, the Russian tradition in classical music is probably as deep-reaching and as profoundly held as puppetry. So how did you navigate that discussion between the kind of songs that you thought the show should have and the kind of songs that your Russian colleagues perhaps thought the show should have?
Well, initially, the music director, who is an extremely accomplished pianist and composer herself, wanted only classical music. And, Sesame Street is known for its innovative music. It's very diverse music. Some of the top musicians in the world had their start at Sesame Street and, were able to make a living until they kind of made it later. And we hoped that the same would be true of Ulitsa Sezam, which means Sesame Street in Russian. But the composer was like, no. And this made sense in terms of their experience, because a lot of children's animated programs had classical music. So that made sense from where she was coming from. But the other thing is that, in my earlier life, I had written a lot about underground rock and roll and had made a film with a friend that was called Rock Around the Kremlin. And it was all about how these musicians had been persecuted under communism and couldn't record their music or sell their music or make a living. And I had hoped in taking this job that I'd be able to bring a lot of these people who had become friends of mine, too, into the fold so that they could be part of creating what would become a new sound for modern Russia, contemporary sounds. And this was something that I thought could be incredibly exciting, you know, and also benefit the show tremendously. But the chief director was like, nope, I don't want that. And eventually I talked to a friend of mine who is now a very famous rock star in Moscow then and now. And I asked him, what could I do? You know, could you help me? And he basically chided me and said, you know, Natasha, you're asking for people to change. And this is a really difficult time. You know, you're expecting too much change too fast. But he also thought that he could contribute and many of the people that he knew could. So he offered to meet with the chief director. And she was very nervous about meeting with him. You know, he had, you know, like he wore leather pants and he had an earring. And, you know, she came from the Moscow Conservatory of Music. And these are worlds that don't usually meet. But eventually she agreed to meet with him. And they hit it off. You know, they had children of the same age. And she learned that my friend had studied classical music before he became a rock star. And he assured her that he could compose music for a children's show that would, you know, knock her socks off. And this, you know, eventually she tried it and became so open to inviting other young people and, you know, non-classical musicians to produce for the show. And the music of Ulitsa Sazam is some of the best of any international co-production I've ever seen.
Now, Natasha, from all of this, let's talk about values, because I think you've touched on this already, and I think it just seems so important that in many ways, all of these navigations and negotiations you were having was really almost around like a microcosm of the discussion of what kind of society Russia wanted to be and what kind of values it wanted to promote to the generation of people that would build that new society. So what were the biggest clashes there, and what kind of process could you put into place to try and to try and build consensus around a set of core values for the show?
Well, I think part of why the book is resonating with people today, and you know, it's just been amazing seeing how it's been embraced both in the US and the UK, is because it deals with values. It looks at a culture, you know, through the prism of the Muppets and making Sesame Street. It looks at how our cultures are different. And it brings in aspects of history and national pride, as well as showing how change happens. And one example of that is, for instance, we were showing clips, we were talking about inclusivity. So this was one value, and every international co-production begins with a curriculum seminar where you bring together the creative team and children's education experts and teachers into a room. And we held this curriculum seminar at the Danilov Monastery, which was it is the headquarters of the Russian Orthodox Church. So we had rented space there. And as we were discussing this topic of inclusivity, which was chosen by the research director, who is Russian, I showed a clip of a little boy in a wheelchair who was flying a kite. And there's a little song in the background, you know, me in my chair, I go everywhere. It's a very cute segment. And the video ends and I'm sitting there smiling. And the team in the room is horrified. And then one guy says, it's so exploitative to show children in wheelchairs on television. And I'm not really sure what to say. That is not what I expected this video would elicit. And then another woman says, very innocently, I don't understand. Why would normalni dzieci, normal children, ever want to watch a TV show with ni normalni dzieci, not normal children? So the use of this language was also, you know, archaic to hear and difficult because, you know, I just thought, okay, these are some of the most enlightened educators. And I'm not sure if this country is ready for Sesame Street, you know, based on the values of the program. But then this other woman raises her hand and she says, you know, you Americans don't understand. Our country has just collapsed. Our healthcare system is in shambles. And there are many children who are trapped in their beds and they will never have a wheelchair. So how will they feel if they see children with wheelchairs on our TV show? So when she says this, I look around the room and many people are crying. This was such an incredibly moving moment, you know, for me as well in the room. And I can imagine for them, it was also painful and humiliating to have this discussion with a group of visiting Americans. So, you know, we took a break, and later when we reassembled, there was a woman who was from Chuvashia area. And she explained that she worked with disabled children every day because in her area, they had the highest incidence of children with deformities because it was a dumping ground for hazardous chemicals under communism. And she said, I know these children. I work with them every day. They yearn to play with normal children, normal children. And she says to the group, we must have scenarios in our show that sees these children as valuable, a valuable part of society. And through this process of discussion, the team moved in that direction. And I didn't have to say a word. It was people talking with each other and realizing the important role that they had to play in the transition of their own country.
It sounds, Natasha, like you built really a community in Moscow around the production of this, you know, and I mean a community really in the sense that it was shared values and an increasingly shared vision. Did those values then kind of an increasing consensus kind of coalesce over the very process of making Sesame Street and the very process of having these discussions and making explicit decisions over what the show should and shouldn't do and should and shouldn't show?
Very much so. I mean, our team got extremely close. And I remember one day when the chief director of Volodya Gramatikov came to me and he said, you know, I remember when I went to Sesame Street in the United States and there was this feeling on the set of a family and people knew each other so well that they really didn't even need to explain things, so that the shooting was so smooth because they understood what they needed to do to produce the show well. And he said, I'm so proud that we now, you know, this was after some weeks of filming, have reached that same level, that we have rebuilt that community in our own country. And people feel like they're part of something and, you know, that is going to change their country for the better.
So take us at the end of all of this struggle and striving and risk and bravery that you and your colleagues showed. Take us to the night that it airs. What was it like to finally see Sesame Street go out in Moscow and across the former Soviet Union?
Yeah, it was very emotional. I write about in my book that I was actually pregnant during the last part of filming and everything. So I had just given birth a couple weeks earlier and left the baby with my husband. And when I got to Moscow, we had a premiere with about 600 people in a theater, and all of the foreign press was there and the Soviet press present. And we presented with our broadcaster. So by then we had a broadcaster, which we did not have until after the show was shot, believe it or not. And our Irina Borisova, my partner, was there, and my colleagues from Sesame Street, Baxter Urish was there, and Leonid. I mean, it was an incredible night. And the children were so excited. They were all sitting in front of the theater on the floor, you know, in front of the stage, because there were so many people there, there weren't enough seats. And Zelyebova comes out. It's the first time children have seen this Muppet character. And they all start screaming, you know, they're just like, ah! So it was just really fun. And then afterwards, I went outside with Leonid to get some air. And we had this press conference show, you know, before the show was going to premiere. So it turned 6 o'clock and we looked, we were outside and it was snowing. And we looked up at the apartment buildings that were surrounding the theater and noticed that the color in the windows, the colors were changing in unison. So it was like all red and then all blue. And we looked at each other and realized, oh my God, that's our show just aired. And there was a lot of press about the show coming out because, as I mentioned, it was a big deal because also there wasn't much available for children. So as we watched this, you know, thinking about all the people in their living rooms, you know, watching the TV show, I mean, it was an incredible feeling of accomplishment. And I was so proud of our team and what we had achieved in the end against incredible odds.
That is just such an arresting, I was going to read that quotation from you, Natasha, if you hadn't mentioned it. Such an arresting moment and image, the idea of seeing your show flickering on in sitting room after sitting room across the entire city. It must have been a moment like no other.
It was incredible. Now, I did want to say, Carl, that it's important for people to know that the show went on to become a huge hit and it aired across all of the former Soviet Union into Russia, Ukraine, Armenia, Georgia, all across the 11 time zones. And it lasted for 10 years. So well into Putin's era, and people that you might meet today who are in their late 20s and 30s, many of the same people that are walking out of Russia now because they don't support the war and they don't want to fight, grew up on Ulitsa Sazam. And that's also true for Ukrainian soldiers, men and women, who are fighting today for their continued independence.
So do you think it did promote the values, Natasha, that you wanted it to, looking back? Do you think, I mean, obviously...
I'm 100% sure. And I think that, you know, in the West now, when we, you know, we have to understand what is at stake for people when they protest. And I'm talking about many of the people, my colleagues that I worked with, who were trying years ago to deal with and challenge Putin's increased repression of a free media and people's self-determination. They had to leave overnight. Many of these people had been active on social media. And when Putin passed the law against speaking out against the special operation, they had to leave. They were in danger of being put in prison for 15 years. And those people who remain and have children and have to care for their children, they are very aware that they cannot go out and protest. Who's going to take care of their children?
Well, this brings us nicely, actually, Natasha, onto one of the questions we have here from Gregory. Thank you, Gregory, who says, was bringing the Muppets to Russia a political project or was it commercial in nature?
Well, Sesame Street is a nonprofit. Sesame Workshop is. And so there was advertising on both ends of the show. So revenue went back to the TV station, the partner, to Sesame Street, and I think there were two stations involved. So I would say it was a public, private, nonprofit, commercial project.
And sorry, this is going to be another one for me, not the audience, but I just actually wanted to just dwell on that final thought you had, Natasha, around the idea that many of, I imagine, your colleagues and people associated with the show have either had to leave or stay silent in Russia now. What do you think we currently get wrong? Do you think we get anything wrong about Russia right now? Do you think there's a kind of a more serious and deeper, if latent and quieter, series of democratic values and commitments to humanism than perhaps we might be seeing from Russia right now when we look at the propaganda shows and when we hear about Putin's speeches and we hear about the repression?
Well, the reason why it's so important to look at this period of the, you know, in the 1990s is that Putin continuously uses this time period as a justification for his increased authoritarianism. So he brings up what the West did to Russia at that time and how, you know, the West is belittling Russia. And he capitalizes a lot on manipulating sentiments that you see in the course of creating Sesame Street, like Russian pride. But as far as what we got wrong, I think, you know, early on during that time period, there was so much effort at stabilizing the ruble and using shock therapy, you know, to build capitalism quickly, that many leaders and economists didn't take into account the human process of how long it takes people to change their views, to be able to assimilate new ways of living and in the world. And we expected, as we do now in many countries, for other nations to mirror our own. And these are very different countries with different values. So that expectation is going to backfire. It backfired then, and it'll backfire now in many countries.
Mm. Would you take the Muppets back to Moscow if you ever got the chance in some imagined post-Putin world?
Yeah. I think we have to be ready when we get the chance again, which I think we will, because all wars end. And this war will thankfully end too. And when we do get that chance, it would be absolutely fantastic to bring Sesame Street there again. And I know there's a team that wants to do it because I talk to them on WhatsApp now.
Well, that's incredibly exciting. And all wars end, and so, alas, do interviews, I'm afraid. But Natasha, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carl.
I cannot tell you both how interesting I found talking to you, but also the book. And everyone, I cannot commend this enough. It is a truly brilliant book. It's an absolutely unbelievable, wild, amazing story, Natasha, that you've brought us. So thank you very much.
If you'd like to hear more, attend some of our excellent events, or peruse our back catalogue, then head to intelligencesquared.com. This episode of the Intelligence Squared podcast was produced by Connor Boyle and edited by Tom Hall. Thanks for listening.